Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, U.S. trade policy. As a presidential candidate, Donald Trump made big promises.
I intend to immediately renegotiate the terms of that agreement to get a better deal by a lot, not just a little, by a lot for our workers.
Now, after two tumultuous years filled with threats, truces, and heavy tariffs, the Trump administration seems to have ended the chaos, or at least put it on pause. I spoke with Anna Swanson of the New York Times. I asked what this deal with China and the new North American trade agreement mean for U.S. businesses, the economy, and American families. We seem to have at least a pause in the U.S.-China trade war. How do you see the deal that is now on the table?
I think that that's right, exactly, that it is a pause in what had been a very tense period in U.S.-China relations. I do think that the deal that President Trump signed at the White House last week has some positive benefits for American industry in terms of opening up Chinese markets for a variety of agricultural products and financial services and containing new promises from China to protect American intellectual property. And a major benefit of the deal will certainly be, you know, a pause in this general kind of downward spiral in U.S.-China relations.
Of course, all depends on China keeping the promises it's made. Isn't that so?
Absolutely, yes. And the administration would say that in order to ensure that China has kept those promises, it has left a great deal of tariffs on the country. And so if China does not follow through on these promises, more tariffs will go back on, and it can use the promise of lowering those tariffs in the future to incentivize more changes. However, in the meantime, all of those tariffs remaining on continue to be difficult for many American industries. Those are things that raise the prices of inputs for manufacturers and raise prices for consumers. And so although there are some significant gains for industry in this trade deal, it also came at quite significant costs as well.
Especially, would you say, for the tech industry?
Yes, I wrote a piece recently just about this very subject. So some of the provisions of the deal, like the protections for intellectual property, which I was talking about, are good for American technology companies. But meanwhile, there has been this much bigger conflict between the United States and China over the technology of the future and technological development. So China is trying to accelerate its efforts to develop indigenous technologies like semiconductors and robotics and really gain an edge in many of these industries. And U.S. tech companies feel that they are losing out on sales to China as a result of these bigger tensions.
What's the backstory on this tech problem? I understand from the piece that you wrote for today's New York Times that, in fact, some of the tech companies feel that China has actually stolen their material or ways to manufacture their material so that China can now do its own without purchasing those from the U.S. companies.
Absolutely. And so that is one thing that the trade deal was meant to address, is these incidents of intellectual property theft. The administration has gotten some promises from China not to do that kind of activity in the future. Of course, it's difficult to say, you know, will China hold to the letter of those commitments? But meanwhile, there are other problems for the tech industry as well, which is kind of China's overall economic model. in various industries, including steel and wind turbines and solar panels, China has had this practice of using massive subsidies and industrial plans and state-owned enterprises to kind of single out these industries that it wants to really develop and accelerate in the future. And so Chinese firms have kind of without regard for, you know, the free market or price considerations, churned out just a huge volume of product, and that has lowered global prices and ended up putting American manufacturers out of business.
So prior to that, American manufacturers were creating their own wind turbines, their own materials for use rather broadly across the U.S. economy. And now China is able to do them at a less expensive price.
That's right. So China has moved into a lot of these segments and just produced a lot of product and lowered prices for those products globally. And you can see that as particularly in solar panels is a great example. China's movement into that sector has ended up lowering prices there and actually resulted in something of a solar energy boom in the United States. So you could argue that that is good for consumers or the environment in a lot of ways. But on the other hand, American manufacturers of those products have also ended up being put out of business.
Put out of business simply because China's products are cheaper. Are they as good?
Well, I think originally, there were many complaints that they weren't as good, you know, and there are always a lot of criticisms that China is a copycatter and, you know, is just copying U.S. designs. However, I think in some areas, China is as good as or better than the United States at this point. I also did an interesting story recently profiling a Chinese maker of subway cars. And so since the Pullman Company went out of business decades ago, there hasn't been an American company that makes these subway cars. And so China has dominated the global industry and now makes some of the most high-tech, high-speed trains. So there are some areas in which China really is on the cutting edge. And American tech industries are concerned that China will move into other segments like semiconductors or robotics or electric vehicles and end up taking a very important commercial and even military edge over the United States.
I'm fascinated with the subway car story. Now, have some of those Chinese-produced subway cars ended up, for example, in New York or even Washington, D.C.?
Oh, absolutely. So this factory I was profiling is outside of Chicago and is fulfilling a contract now for the Chicago L, but their cars are all around the country. Actually, Washington, I believe, decided not to purchase the cars because there were concerns from some in the Capitol here about certain security threats, you know, with having a Chinese state-owned company supplying subway cars. You can debate whether there are really security threats or whether it's more of a protectionist effort by some American freight train companies, but what ended up happening is there was actually legislation passed late last year that would bar this Chinese state-owned company from having any future contracts in the United States for public metro rail systems. So in the future, we won't be buying our subway cars from China, even though they are cheaper and arguably better.
Fascinating. Tell me the areas in which China has agreed to make greater purchases from the U.S.
So another major part of the China trade deal is this purchasing component. So as the president has announced, China has agreed to purchase $200 billion in additional products over the next 2 years, which is really a massive amount. There has been a lot of skepticism from experts about whether or not China is really going to meet those targets.
What kinds of products?
The biggest portions are in manufactured goods and energy. There are also significant agricultural purchases, and then there are some services in there too. So just to break it down, China is purchasing more pork, more soybeans, more Boeing airplanes. Then in the realm of tourism, you know, maybe there are some new promises in terms of raising revenue from Chinese students coming to the United States or tourists coming in as well.
The big question will be whether China lives up to the deal. How long do they have to prove themselves?
Well, there's a variety of timelines on, you know, many different promises that they've made in the deal, whether it's, you know, opening up a particular market for infant formula or opening up a segment of their financial market to American firms. So I think the U.S. administration will be watching very carefully to see if China follows these commitments. And if they don't, there is always the risk of more tariffs coming back on. And so I think one important thing to emphasize is that this trade pact also may not prove to be that durable if China doesn't meet the commitments. We could end up right back where we were before in terms of the trade war.
How unusual is it to target specific items in a trade deal?
I think that in terms of the specific targets for market opening or agreements in terms of agricultural products or financial firms, that is not particularly unusual. What is unusual about this trade deal is the big commitment to make a specific amount of purchases. And actually, it's very interesting because that goal of securing that China makes a specific amount, a dollar value of purchases, contradicts and kind of goes against the goals that the U.S. has pursued in China for a long time. And by that, I mean that past administrations had pushed China to be more of a free market economy and to kind of relax the control of the government over the economy. With this deal, instead, the Trump administration is saying that Chinese state-owned enterprises should make a certain amount of purchases in a specific amount of time. So it's much more of a controlled, kind of managed approach to the economy than trade deals had been in the past.
From your perspective, how big a deal is this China agreement?
I think that's a great question. And, you know, there are various ways to answer that. I do think that it is a sizable deal in terms of what predecessors have gotten from China. So, you know, the president likes to say that this is the biggest trade deal in the history of the world. That is not true. But you could say it's probably the biggest trade deal that the U.S. has had with China since the WTO accession that President Clinton negotiated, under which China made a lot of promises to open its economy. The president has talked about that deal being, you know, the worst deal in the history of the world, but let's set that aside. I think that did probably contain more economic promises from China than this deal. This deal, it's fairly modest in size, but I think, you know, given the challenges between the United States and China, your expectations also have to be somewhat modest. So, yeah, I would say that it has surpassed some people's fairly low expectations.
So how long before these trade agreements go into place?
I believe they take effect 30 days after the signing of the trade deal, which was last week. So we should start to see some changes.
And meanwhile, all the tariffs stay in place?
Yes. So that is actually a really important feature of the trade deal. So even after the deal is signed, the United States is going to be maintaining tariffs on over $360 billion of Chinese products. So more than two-thirds of the products that China sent to the United States last year. A portion of that, over $100 billion, the United States is going to lower the tariff rate from 15% to 7.5%. But it's not going to eliminate those tariffs. So that's one very interesting feature of the deal. We thought that it might lead to a significant rollback in tariffs. Actually, it has left a significant number of these tariffs still in place.
A quick break. More from Anna Swanson when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District,
Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here is the rest of my conversation with Anna Swanson. She writes about trade policy and international economics for the New York Times. So, overall, is the American public going to see benefits? And I'm not talking simply about the large manufacturers or the large industrial tech producers. How are we going to benefit from this deal?
It sounds like the question you're asking is, does this deal fulfill a bigger promise that the president made about the revival of American manufacturing, refiguring trade to really benefit Americans who had been losing out as a result of outsourcing and this kind of restructuring of the global economy? And honestly, no, I think this deal probably just affects things around the margins for American companies.
Really?
It does make operating, you know, life there easier, but I don't think it will do too much to change the structure, that bigger economic structure that has resulted in a lot of our products being imported from elsewhere and the U.S. economy focusing these days on services rather than manufacturing, despite what the president says about those.
So, for example, when someone goes to a big box store to buy a television set, is the price going to be lower than it might have been otherwise without this deal?
No, I don't think so. Because, you know, many of these products, as you said, were made in China and were being imported to the United States. Some of these products the United States has placed tariffs on as part of the trade war, which has increased that price. And those tariffs will remain on. So that will, you know, remain a fact of life. Some instances, the companies have responded to tariffs by moving out of China and moving into places like Vietnam or Mexico. And so some global manufacturing activity has kind of reorganized as a result of the trade war. But I don't think that will end up lowering prices for consumers because, you know, if it were not for the tariffs, companies were producing more cheaply, more efficiently in China. So actually, you know, moving all of that manufacturing comes at a significant cost to companies.
It sounds as though what you're saying is that this China trade deal may be great for the stock market, but not so great for the everyday person who may not have a portfolio.
I think that's right. I mean, the one exception to that you might say is the effects for farmers, because China has promised to open its market for pork, soy, dairy products, a wide variety of products. So if you're an American farmer or someone who works in a job that supports the farming community, maybe there will be more business and more benefit to you. I mean, the farming economy has really been in crisis these last few years, in part due to the effects of the trade war. And so this deal will help address that in part. But I agree with you that, you know, a big beneficiary of this deal is the stock market. And in the ceremony where the president signed the trade deal with China last week, if you looked at the audience, it included a lot of heads of Wall Street firms, big Fortune 500 companies, and the president spent a long time calling them out and talking about how much the deal would benefit their interests as well. So I think that was very explicit.
So how is the ordinary voter? How is the ordinary taxpayer going to feel about this deal? Are we going to see it as something that really is good for the entire country, or are we going to see it as something that's good for the 1%?
To be honest, I think the way people will view this deal probably depends on their political persuasion. At this point in the United States, it seems like even economics has become so polarized, right, that people who support the president are going to view this, you know, believe what he says about this being a fantastic trade deal, and people who don't are going to weigh more heavily to the skeptics who say, you know, this is a relatively modest deal and there's way more to be done in the U.S.-China relationship. This deal does not necessarily address a lot of the complaints that the president had about China taking American manufacturing jobs and all of those criticisms that were tied to the way that outsourcing had eroded American manufacturing and the middle class. And this deal really doesn't address those issues in the U.S.-China relationship. It doesn't get at the major Chinese subsidies and industrial plans that China has used to target manufacturing industry after manufacturing industry. So I don't think it can credibly claim to be something that will boost the middle class or reverse the process of the bigger divide between the rich and the poor in this country.
Let's talk about another big trade deal, how NAFTA has been replaced by the USMCA. Talk about that deal, how much change there really is between NAFTA and this new deal.
So this is a sizable deal. A great portion of it is actually pretty much an update to the original NAFTA. So the original NAFTA was signed a quarter century ago. It doesn't contain things like the internet. So a major impetus for passing this revised deal was simply to update this agreement for the 21st century and be able to control things like e-commerce or digital trade. So that certainly is a big portion of the deal. However, I do think there are a certain amount of other changes to the deal that the Trump administration has certainly put its stamp on NAFTA. I certainly do not agree with the president's characterization of NAFTA being the worst deal in the history of the world and USMCA being something totally different. I mean, they are, you know, it's an updated version of NAFTA, so that really does not make any sense. But I do think that his administration has put its own stamp on the deal.
And what kind of stamp is that?
So one of the most prominent features of the deal is that it raises the threshold for automobile manufacturing in North America. So it has basically a higher requirement for American-made content in North American-made content in automobiles that would get the zero tariffs, get the benefits of the pact. And in short, that's a way of kind of incentivizing auto manufacturing to occur in North America rather than parts to be shipped in from elsewhere around the world and then assembled into a car in the United States. And so this was a very controversial part of the deal because it's something that raises prices. It could slow down the auto industry in terms of their global competitiveness because they're no longer sourcing parts from the part of the world that is most efficient. They have to source them from a particular place. But the Trump administration's goal was to incentivize manufacturing here. And so this is just one example, but there are a few different ways in which the deal kind of raises thresholds and in terms of it trying to incentivize manufacturing here rather than free trade deals in the past, which focused on cutting these barriers to allow kind of the more free trade across borders.
You use those two words, free trade. It would seem that President Trump is somehow putting a different stamp on those two words.
I think that's absolutely true. In practice, his administration doesn't talk about free trade very much. They talk about fair trade, balanced trade. So I think there's a broader recognition from many people of both parties, actually, Democrats and Republicans, that they want to do something different than the old model of free trade, which focused more on lowering barriers, lowering tariffs, and allowing goods to move kind of more freely around the world. You know, that characterization has a lot of critics, people who say it wasn't actually free trade. It was actually a way of writing the rules to benefit global corporations. And, you know, if these were free trade deals, they wouldn't be thousands of pages. A lot of it is about changing the rules to incentivize certain companies and certain industries. But that set aside, I do think that there is a bigger shift in the United States among both Democrats and Republicans away from this kind of unquestioning support of free trade towards something that looks a little more like managed trade. You could quibble with that language, but, you know, an emphasis that the United States maybe needs to keep features like tariffs or like the automobile requirements that are in USMCA to control, you know, where manufacturing occurs, or that the United States needs to hold China to making a certain dollar value of purchases like the Trump administration has in this China deal in order to ensure that trade is fair. So it's a much more hands-on approach than both parties had supported in the past. And I think it's a reaction to the global financial crisis and, you know, the outsourcing that people feel this trade practices has brought on.
So you're saying Democrats have been equally in favor of these new approaches to trade?
Well, their policies are a little bit different, definitely. But it's true that Democrats actually supported many of the features that are in USMCA. For example, the deal strips out a kind of dispute settlement mechanism for corporations that had allowed corporations to, for example, sue the Canadian government over environmental regulations. That's something that, you know, Democrats saw as unfair for corporations, and the Trump administration saw as a way to incentivize outsourcing and a way that companies could basically violate American sovereignty. So that was an issue where, you know, Democrats in the Trump administration found common ground and ended up with a different deal in USMCA. And there are kind of a variety of examples where the Trump administration has taken something from the Democratic playbook, you know, which of course long appealed to unions and workers before the president campaigned on those ideas.
Is there anything in this China-U.S. trade deal talking about or affecting the environment?
Not that I know of. And that has been one criticism of the U.S.-China trade deal and of USMCA, for sure. The USMCA does include some environmental provisions, but it does not include the words climate change. And that has become an issue for some Democrats in supporting the deal.
And of course, the president speaking today in Davos totally rejected anything in regard to a statement that there is global warming.
Mm-hmm. So I was talking about the similarities between Republicans and Democrats' plans for trade in terms of, you know, thinking more about American workers. But you've put your finger on one very particular difference, which is that you hear all of the Democratic candidates emphasizing how trade deals need to address the issue of the environment. And that really is not a feature of Trump administration trade deals.
Anna Swanson, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And that's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. Our engineers this week are Natalie Yurev-Livker and Kenny Pirog. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.